Welcome to the Open House podcast site, available at openhousecommunity.com.au.
Tim Winton is Australia's favourite novelist. His 1991 novel, Cloud Street, was voted Australia's top book by the Australian Society of Authors. He's won the Miles Franklin Award a record four times. But he says writing actually gets harder. Starting again on a new book is like learning to write all over again. His millions of admirers around the world are delighted that he's done it again with his new novel, Airy, centred in Fremantle in his home state of WA. It has lots to say about environmentalism, one of Tim's personal passions, human relationships, struggle, disillusionment, and clearly his disillusionment with the economic engine room of WA and the mining boom. Tim Winton's enormous success has seen him move out of middle class to bourgeois, a reality that sits uncomfortably with him. He's lived a life of intriguing Christian faith in a land, he says, is deeply spiritual with a deeply irreligious culture on top of it. He says he feels like a Catholic when he's with Protestants and like a Protestant when he's with Catholics. And he says, you can be sure a lot of Christians wouldn't have a beer with me. I reckon it'd be their great loss. You don't often see Tim Winton pop up on the public stage. He's often referred to as reclusive, who shuns the limelight. So with the release of Airy, it's a great treat to have him on Open House. Tim Winton, welcome.
Thank you. Thanks for having me.
It's great to have you with us. Thank you so much. Why is it that most of the time you shun the public eye?
Because I'm a writer and I'm not a pundit. I'm not a professional opinion maker. I'm not a commentator. I'm not a public intellectual. I spend as much time as I can just being who I am rather than who I'm not.
I get it. So what's it like when you have to embark on this kind of circus every few years with a book?
Pretty confronting. I mean, look, it's a privilege to have people interested in my work. It's nice to be published. It's nice to still be able to write. So I'm not. There's no point in me whinging about it because that would just be ridiculous. But it is pretty odd if you spend most of your life in some kind of solitude. I mean, really. I mean, I'm a person with a family, like lots of people. But I spend most of my day with people who don't exist in a room on my own. So when I come out and sort of have to do this stuff, I have to find some extra, you know, muscle that I don't normally exercise.
I totally get it. Can you give us a sketch of the story of Airy, of Tom Keeley, the burnout green warrior, six-year-old Kai, and how it all fits in Fremantle? And why Fremantle?
Well, Fremantle's an interesting community. It's a small city. It's a port town. Because it is a port town, it sort of produces a different social reality. I mean, lots of different sort of people living together. The old wharf community of workers, the migrant communities, the fishing community. So it's a real multicultural, you know, it's a real mix. And also a mix of socioeconomic groups as well. So it's a traditional working town, but it's become sort of middle class just by its, you know, prosperity. And so it's an interesting mix. There's a lot of community activism involved in Frio. It was always a town where if there was going to be a demo or a town hall meeting or some kind of political activism, that it was going to happen in Frio. So it's a bit of a political vortex.
And Tom Keeley is a burnt-out political eco-activist.
Yeah, Tom's a guy who had been a very prominent advocate for environmental issues in his state nationally. And he's lost his job from truth-telling, really. He's said something that's perfectly true and factual. It's just deeply inconvenient to powerful people and therefore catastrophic to his own job prospects. So he says something at a press conference that he's never going to escape. I guess we've all seen what happens to whistleblowers anywhere. He becomes unemployed, the marriage goes south, he loses a nice house, and he ends up at the top floor of a rather seedy block of flats in the unfashionable end of town. And he's more or less taken out divorce proceedings against his fellow humans. He's trying to disprove John Donne's assertion that no man is an island. He's trying to make himself an island. But life has other ideas for Tom, and essentially John Donne is proved right that Keeley, whether he likes it or not, he is involved with mankind.
And Kai, this six-year-old boy, and the big question is he going to be able to save the boy?
Yeah, he meets these people in the apartment block who sort of intervene in his life and interrupt his solitude, if you like, his angry privacy. They require something of him, and Kai is the means by which life reaches back to Keeley and wrenches him from his sort of sulking solitude. And there's this little boy who's damaged and traumatised and in need of help. I'm anxious not to give too much away the story, but this is a childless man in middle age who has both a father-shaped hole in his life because his dad, Nev Keeley, was a sort of a moral giant in his view. But Keeley also has a child-shaped hole in his life because he's never been a father. And this boy, just very strange, damaged boy, seems to be reaching out to him, needing help. And Keeley can't help but help. That's in his nature.
It's a great story. And Perth is described as a pastel toy town which has bulldozed its past and buried its doubts. At one point, Tom Keeley looks down on Fremantle, and this is a quote, which had become a boho theme park perched on a real estate bubble, and behind every neglected gold rush facade and vacant shopfront was a slum landlord counting pennies, lording it over family and bitching about refugees. Where's all that come from?
I guess I have to be careful to distinguish between myself and the character, but it's not as if I don't share some of those opinions some of the time. Lucky for me, you know, I'm not Tom Keeley and I wake up most days in a better shape than he's in. But there are sad things in community where, and I don't think Fremantle's any exception, but a lot of communities are almost stuck in a kind of, in a holding pattern of taking and not giving. And it's tough in a prosperous town like Fremantle to see so many vacant shop fronts. You know, the people who own them are getting wealthier between breakfast and lunch, and it doesn't matter if anybody's in them in those buildings or not. They're playing a game of Monopoly.
You've got a great affection for the working class.
Yeah, I don't think I'm sentimental about the working class. I'd risen from, not really from middle class to bourgeoisie, I'd risen from working class to bourgeoisie. My parents were from pretty humble origin. My grandfather was a wharfie. Both my parents were taken out of school very young because of their social circumstances. So I don't think I'm sentimental about it, but I am conscious of my origins, and I'm also conscious of the fact that that's still a living, unfolding entity. I live in several worlds at once, if you like. There are people in, there are members in my family who can't read and write, and there are some of us who have several university degrees and have, you know, very prominent jobs, and the spectrum is not in the past, you know. So, and in the same way, I live some of my life in the city and some of my life in the country, and that's a great privilege.
There's also a bit of a burnt out environmental warrior in you.
You lose a bit of bark, there's no question, and you have moments when you get a little disillusioned. But no, I'm still actively involved how and when I can, and I'm still hopeful. You know, I haven't crashed and burned like poor old Keeley.
You're a storyteller. Can I ask you this question about what you think of how Australia's unfolding story is being told today in public life and in the media?
It's hard to talk about without, you know, looking like you're pointing the finger or ticking people off. I don't know. Sometimes I'm disappointed in the way that, as you say, our national story is being told. It's something a little narrow and noxious about it, the way it seems to be appealing. A lot of times I think commentary and journalism and broadcasting seems to be appealing to the narrowest and nastiest instincts in our culture, and that's disheartening and it really saddens me. And I think people want to be decent, people want to be good, people as a culture and as communities want to be bigger. I think we all recognise when somebody's appealing to our higher instincts, and it's really disheartening to see this almost constant diet of noxious narrowness and people appealing to our lowest instincts.
With lots of jobs, they get somewhat easier with time and experience, but that's not necessarily the case with writing, you say? It gets harder.
Yeah, that's true. I mean, it seems bizarre to say it and to probably to hear it, but I find that the older I get, I mean, I've been doing this for 30-something years. I'm very grateful just to have been able to do it, and I'm grateful that I can still do it, you know, as of last week. But whether I can do it next week or next year, I can't take for granted. It's just every book needs to be written as though you've never written a book before. I mean, and every book is a different story, and it needs telling in its own way. And Yeah, I think if I had some other kind of skill where you're sort of skilled up to a certain point and then you just repeat the knowledge that you've learned, that'd be handy. But part of the mystery of being a storyteller is that you just don't know what is about to happen, or if you can do it, or it's a bit like being a farmer, you just never know if it's going to rain.
Is it scary then?
Yeah, it is scary. It's more scary in retrospect because you don't often realise how close you've been skating to the edge until afterwards. But yeah, when you have to make a living from thin air, you know, you're making something out of nothing. That's a little scary, but it's a huge privilege to be able to do something like this. You know, to be a musician or a painter or a writer, or you're conscious that you've been given a gift and you feel obliged to exercise it with as much care and consciousness as you can.
Can I ask you about optimism? You categorise it as more a discipline than an emotional state. In fact, you have to manufacture optimism?
Yeah, I mean, I'm only speaking about myself, but I mean, obviously I experience optimism as an emotion the way anybody does, but in terms of when I'm honest about myself and my general outlook, I realise I'm probably not instinctively an optimist. And I have said in the past that I adopt optimism as a discipline because it's a framework that I use to get through the day and to get myself past whatever obstacles or lurking despair or disappointments or fears that you have. In the same way that any parent has to, taking your children out into the world, and you have to, for their sake, you have to live as though life is possible, as though you're in control, as if you've got to tell them that they're going to be all right. And what's the alternative? Despair. Lots of us in our lives adopt disciplines to keep ourselves together, and I think my kind of optimism is one of those things where I just think, I need to keep myself together. Otherwise, if you get tired and you have five bad nights in a row, and all it takes is five bad nights, and you're in a dark place.
And who wants to be around you? On Open House, we're with Tim Winton. Tim, your Christian faith was shaped powerfully by your parents' story. Your dad, who was a policeman, had a terrible accident on his motorbike.
This was in the 1960s. I was the oldest child. I was about 5 years old, I think. And I had a younger brother, and my mum was pregnant. Dad was a traffic cop, and he was knocked off his motorbike and went through a factory wall. And he was in a coma for weeks. And because I was so young, you know, I just thought that, you know, my father was suddenly absent from being always with us, just suddenly absent. And I think I was told that he was in hospital, but after a while, you know, as a kid, you start to smell a rat, you know, because there was no access. My mother said years and years later that Dad's workmates brought the clothes that they'd cut off him. I don't know why they thought that was a good idea, but there was a kind of a trauma in that. There was for me to feel that, you know, my father, who'd been this strong presence, being taken away. Anyway, he did come back, but he came back in a kind of a... He was a bit shop-soiled when he showed up. I mean, when my father was finally released from hospital, they wheeled him into the house and I didn't even recognise him. And he'd had a tracheotomy and he was breathing through a... They had a big bandage across his throat, and every time it whistled when he breathed, and it lifted in and out. It was like a horror movie, you know. He was very different physically, and it took him a very long time to recover. But during that period, a bloke just showed up at the door and knocked on the door and said to my mum, "I've heard that you need some help." You know, Dad was a big bloke and mum couldn't carry him to the bath or anything. And this guy used to come around every day and bathe my father. You know, it was all very strange to me, and I became very protective of my mother as the man of the house at 5 years old. And this guy, lovely man, just he used to come and carry Dad to the bath and bathe him, and they used to talk, and I used to listen at the bathroom door. And I think that was a big emotional and spiritual turning point for both my parents.
This bloke was from the local church.
Yeah, and he used to just talk to Mum and Dad, and I think for them there was an instance where, you know, there was a sort of moment of grace where they were experiencing faith active in love. You know, it's just a person. He wasn't there to convert them. He was just there to help them. But it changed their life, and I think it was this expression of decency and kindness and sacrifice and humility that changed their lives and basically changed our whole life. Mum and Dad became, I think they were very devout and faithful people from then on, they become very, very active in their local church. They, it was during the period of the Billy Graham and Leighton Ford crusades that all that was in the air, became a, you know, a big influence on our lives. And that knock on the door, that act of community, if you like, it's hard to fathom just how far that resonates from one act and one moment of decency, you know, for our whole family.
Far more practical than theoretical or theological, more hands than head.
No question of that. All the theology can catch up to itself in another time, you know, as it sees fit. But for me, that's still, you know, a central moment in my life. I don't know it is for my parents. And the ripples just spread out. So over my own journey, if you like, whenever I've had, you know, plenty of times to be in conflict with myself and with the church and to be questioning this and that, whenever I get ensnared in all of that stuff, I take myself back to those kind of experiences in my life where I think, well, actually, that's what it's about. I'm not interested in arguing theology with anybody anymore. That's what I come back to. It's moments of, you know, recognition of love between people, you know, a response to the divine.
For many people who grow up in a family with faith like that, they'll go on to continue to embrace it. Many will also walk away from it after they get out of adolescence. But you wrestled with it for quite a time.
As a child, obviously, you have the faith of a child, and that's fine. But because there was a real life experience of something being manifested before me, that was a core thing that couldn't be taken away from me when it did come to periods of confusion and conflict. I think I wrestled with it because it was important. And I became an arrogant young teenager, like anybody, you know. But it was important to me, and it frustrated me that people would always resort to easy answers and smugness. And I just thought that the faith was more valuable than that. It was too important for smugness. It's almost as though people were accepting sort of forms and received ideas without having challenged them themselves. But it was hard because I was brought up in a kind of a fundamentalist tradition, which is a sort of yeoman's religion. It was, you know, ordinary people's religion, and people weren't educated. The church communities I grew up in, most people hadn't done much more than a primary school education or had been past, say, 14 or 15 in school. And yet their church communities had taught them to be literate. You know, they were very scripturally literate. So, you know, that in a sense, culture was alive in them, language was alive in them, music was very important. But as a person who has suddenly then gone to university and I read outside the fence, if you like, I was a questioning, difficult presence. There's no question about that.
And you developed great suspicions about the church. Not that you were falling out of love with God, but seriously falling out of love with the church.
Yeah, and I think I'm always grateful for the fact that I never confused God with the church. The church is a means by which people worship and commune with each other. It's not the point, it's just the means. And I think had I confused the two, as I knew other people around me had, and they became deeply disillusioned with the church, therefore they'd lost their faith, and I thought it was an enormous tragedy, and it was very painful to see that happen. In the end, you know, a church is just a group of people. And whether it's a sporting group or an environmental group or, you know, whatever you like, a political party, it's just a group of people. And people are going to do great things and they're going to do awful things. And if you have a little club environment, you know, it gets very airless. And unless you open a window or two, things get very stale and nasty. And you know, it's not as if great things aren't possible in community groups and churches. It's just, I think people need to examine themselves a little bit. And look, I was an arrogant young man. It's not as if I had any answers, and I was probably impatient. But I think people need to remember that it goes right back to the early fathers. We're dealing with a mystery. We're dealing with a great, confounding gift of mystery, and we're constantly trying to capture that mystery and put it in a safe and wave the title deeds in front of strangers.
There's one quote of yours that entirely arrested me, coming from an author. You said, "The less I've read on God, the more it's helped, and the bigger the picture has got."
I think probably what I meant was that I had spent years in my teens and in my 20s reading theology, Theology is more of a speculative science. At its very best, it's closer to poetry than it is to academic or journalism or anything like that. It's people yearning to describe something mysterious. I was trying to get my thinking right, and I was in the deluded idea that orthodoxy was essentially worth the effort, and I think I was distracted from living and living faith. Once I sort of relented a little bit, it's not that I don't read theology anymore, but I don't read it and engage in the same sort of combative, trying to count the angels on the head of a pin sort of thing that you get involved in.
So where do you go then? Where is that bigger picture painted for you?
I guess I had forgotten that the material world, the created world, is the chief means of revelation. You know, that's our chief experience of the divine in the things that are manifest all around us, in the lives that are being lived, in all the ecosystems that are surrounding us, and in the lives of people. The material world is holy. That part of the sacred had somehow just gone over my head as a younger person. So there's that. And also just, I think I just became a little more attuned to the holiness of people and the struggles of other people working out their lives in faith and their wonder all around me. They were the books I probably should have been attending to with at least as much interest as the books of theology that I was thumbing.
Do you read much of the Bible? Do you go to church much?
I'm not sure if I'm a paid-up God botherer, but I still am a parish member. I go to an Anglican church. Not really much of an Anglican, probably, but the nice thing about is that with the Anglicans, they'll have you anyway. I still read scripture because it's so fundamentally part of my background, and it's still, you know, it was a form of inspiration to me. I mean, even in terms of language as a writer, having grown up with the King James Version and then all the other versions, you know, the Revised Standard Version and all the others. Well, there was one that had stick figures. It was great. Was it the Good News Bible or the
That's the one.
I always thought the diagrams could do with a little bit of elaboration, but. It's still important to me, and even with this book, which begins with a couple of verses from the prophet Isaiah, talks about those that wait on the Lord, or those that fear the Lord will rise up with wings as eagles, and will run and not be weary, and walk and not faint. To me, that resonates, obviously, within my faith tradition, but it resonates for me, and I hope it will resonate for people who don't see themselves as religious, in the sense of those who keep faith, those who hold fast to life, those who keep their ear open, those who are still open to the mystery of life and each other. Eventually you will feel some strength. You know, losing faith with faith and losing faith in life is the path to despair and isolation. And I still think that regardless of how we describe ourselves, if we're still open, maybe we will rise on wings as eagles and run the race and not fall. That's my hope anyway.
Tim Whitten, I'm so grateful for your time. You've been very generous with us on Open House. Thank you so much indeed for joining us.
Oh, it's a pleasure. Thanks, mate.
We hope you enjoyed this Open House podcast. To hear more from Open House, visit openhousecommunity.com.au.